Oh, spring day. The season has been bursting to appear for the last several weeks. Spring to me represents the eternal message of hope imprinted deep within nature. And when the springtime comes, I find myself wanting to turn away from the problems of the day, the policies and economics, and to draw close again to the thrust of our tradition. For somehow in its depth and its beauty, in its longevity, and the fact that we are here and they have always been here, I find that hope, that faith which transcends the dark headlines, and that hope and that faith which gives us some measure of confidence for the future. So I have no political message to sell this morning, no economic truth to lay bare before you, no great words of wisdom about the policies of the day. I simply like to investigate that little book, a chapter of which we read this morning, the Pirkei Avot, the Sayings of the Fathers. As we read that chapter, we participated in a 1,200-year-old history. For it's been the custom in Israel, ever since the days of the great Geonim of Babylon, the 8th and 9th century, to read a chapter of the Sayings of the Fathers on each of the weeks that fall between the Passover holiday and the festival of Shavuot. Now, as we read from these proverbs, we recognized that they are drawn together chronologically rather than topically. By that I mean simply that they are not organized by subject, by heading, but simply quoted in the name of some rabbinic authority or other, and that these authorities are listed in descending order of age, the earliest first and the more recent last. We found some of these aphorisms to be sermonic. Hillel's wonderful hope, be of the disciples of Aaron, loving peace and pursuing peace, loving all fellow men, seeking to draw them near into the Torah. Some of them seemed full of insight, thoughtful, even philosophic. If I'm not for myself, who will be for me? If I'm for myself alone, what am I? And if not now, when? And all of them were redolent with the culture, the ethos of the rabbis, with their love of the traditional books and the traditional learning, their acceptance of rabbinic authority, the rabbi as a figure, the central figure in the justice system, the law, the halakha, as the central principle of justice, their faith in a God who is both just and merciful, and in the rewards and punishments which come to the obedient and to the sinner in this world and in the world of to come. Be deliberate in judgment, raise up many disciples, and build a fence around the Torah. Now, as we read from this wisdom, each of us dismissed some of it as irrelevant, as unrelated to our own experience. Each of us brought our own experience to the text and found some of them pregnant with meaning, significant. Each of us related this ancient wisdom to our own day. You remember the phrase of Simeon ben Gamaliel, I have passed all my days in the company of the wise, and I have found nothing more significant than this. But nothing is better than silence. Not the learning, but the doing is the chief thing, and that he who multiplies words multiplies sin. Nothing is better than silence. How often have we opened our mouths and put our foot in them? How often have we spoken impulsively, regretted it? Not the learning, but the doing is the chief thing. Learning is not an end in itself. There's no virtue in being a living encyclopedia. There's a time when everyone has to leave the ivory tower and put his wisdom such as it is to work. I have thought often of the last of these three terms. He who multiplies words multiplies sin. I've wondered how often our Secretary of State has multiplied words to this head of state in Southeast Asia, in the Middle East, weaving a web of words which promise so much, but in actuality pledge so little, assuring with words what is not being assured in deeds, multiplying sin. Now, as we read through these texts, I think most of you recognize that far from being single proverbs, usually three sentences, three aphorisms are quoted in the name of each sage. And here too, there's a bit of wisdom. Usually a single truth is simplistic. Only as truth is balanced with some other wisdom does it relate to the grays, which are the very central element of life. If we heard alone, naught is better than silence, we might believe that they're espousing here that kind of army barracks wisdom, which says, never volunteer, never raise your hand, never do more than you have to do. But when you balance naught is better than silence with not the learning, but the doing is the chief thing, you recognize that the rabbis did not have this kind of self-serving prudence in mind, but they were simply cautioning people against running at the mouth, against talking assertively or authoritatively of that which they barely know, of making sure of their commitments before they commit themselves, but then, by God, do it. Be active. Be involved. We read the text here in this lovely room during this quiet service in a very naked form. These are words in type outside of history. The only history most of us bring to it is the history of our own lives, our own experience. But it's often interesting to relate the text to the authority and the authority to his time. Take the text that I have been dealing with. Naught is better than silence, not the learning, but the doing is the chief thing. He who multiplies words multiplies sin. This text is given in the name of one Simeon ben Gamaliel. And in Jewish history, we know that Simeon ben Gamaliel was a leader of the Pharisees, perhaps the leader of the Pharisaic group, in the decade immediately preceding the great revolt against Rome, which led to the final destruction of the temple. He lived in a roiling and confusing age. And there were many about in that period who were demanding, demonstrating, speaking from pulpits in the street, the public, attacking Rome, demanding rebellion, revolt, action. There were even some who had become political assassins, guerrilla terrorists, the Sicarii. The Sicarii is a kind of dagger which was held, and they tried to assassinate one Roman general after another. Now, obviously, Israel suffered under the Roman yoke. Roman taxation was vicious, voracious. Roman authority brooked no dissent, but still the temple was open. Some life could go on. Despite the penalties, despite the subjugation, despite the indignities, there were those who said, little Israel cannot defeat Rome. Revolt is not a wise thing. To all the demonstrators of his day, to all those who had to get up and give vent to the purity of their passions, obviously this statement by Gamaliel was something of a political program, something of the political program of the Pharisees. Naught is better than silence. There's sometimes when you face the wrath and the fury of the tyrant, naught is better than silence. But at the same time, within his own group, within the Pharisees, there were those who were so timid, who were so afraid of anything that smacked an assertive Jewishness, that they said, let's study quietly among ourselves. Let's not participate in any of the great public acts, the meetings at the cult center in Jerusalem, festival pilgrimages to Jerusalem. Not the learning, but the doing is the chief thing. And there were others, obviously, in that day who couldn't leave the problem alone. We've seen them in our own time. Whenever there's a crisis, there are a number of people who are like the lightning bug, moving all around the crisis, this way and that, inside and out of it, taking any position, every position, for the sheer love of being part of it, for the sheer love of expressing themselves, talking endlessly without consequence. He who multiplies words multiplies sin. These phrases are interesting. These proverbs are fascinating. But a larger question must confront us, because we didn't read this text simply as a book of ancient wisdom. We read it as part of the required ritual tradition of our people. Why so? How is it that these six chapters of the sayings of the fathers became part of the liturgy of our people? And the question is a rather interesting one, because there's a greater book of wisdom than this, the book of Proverbs in the Bible. And that book of Proverbs has greater antiquity and authority than this little book does. It's traditionally associated with the name of that wise King Solomon. Never once was it suggested by anyone that the book of Proverbs be read as part of our service. In fact, no section of the book of Proverbs is suggested as a reading, as a haftarah reading, a reading to supplement the reading from the Torah. And there's another great book of ancient wisdom, several hundred years older than the sayings of the fathers, the wisdom of Joshua ben Sirach, the second century Jerusalem teacher and sage, which is part of our Apocrypha, which is called Ecclesiasticus, or the wisdom of ben Sirach. And that text is never used liturgically. Why should this text be so used? The answer is an interesting one. It seems to have first been authorized as part of synagogue ritual in the 8th or 9th century by the Babylonian Geonim. We're now in the period when the Arab conquest had taken over the world, when Jewish life was organized under the Geonim, the rabbinate, with its great centers in Baghdad and the academies of Sura and Pumbedita. And it was these men who prescribed the reading of these six chapters and stipulated that they be read in the weeks between Passover and Shavuot. Why did they do so? Unfortunately, they have not left us any full explanation, but there's a suggestion of an explanation. When they describe this custom and prescribe it, require it, they describe it not as instructional, not as Torah, but as chassidut, as an act of piety. And if I may be allowed a bit of historical reconstruction, I'd like to suggest the reason. During the age of the Geonim, a great sect arose among Jews who were opposed to the authority and to the power of the rabbis of the Geonate. They're known as the Karaites, from the word to read Torah, Mikra. The Karaites grew up in Persia, in the eastern parts of the Arab Empire. They were unhappy with the way in which the rabbinate had failed to manage to get certain privileges during the period of disturbance between the destruction of the Byzantine Sassanid empires and the rise of the Arabs. They were filled with the messianic hope of our Jewish people. They were much more active Zionistically in terms of the rebuilding of Palestine, of the Holy Land, than the rabbinate was, which made its peace with the Arab conquerors. And more than this, these Karaites denied the very authority of the rabbinates. They denied that the scholars, the rabbis, had the authority to impose the Talmud, the halakha, the rabbinic way of life upon the Jewish community. The rabbis claimed that at Sinai there had been two great revelations, one the Torah as we know it, and one a Torah Sheba'al Peh, an oral tradition, which had been handed down from authorized teacher to authorized teacher. It was as much the revelation of the word of God, the will of God, as the written Torah itself. And it included all the new prescriptions which rabbinic Judaism had imposed upon Jewish life. This myth, this assumption of historical assumption, this claim of a twofold revelation, the Karaites denied. They claimed that there was only one revelation at Sinai, the written law, the Bible as we know it. They were a strong and powerful group. And it's my conviction that the rabbis organized the reading of these six chapters of the Pirkei Avot as a kind of loyalty oath taken in every synagogue in the weeks preceding Shavuot. Why Shavuot? Why this time of the year? The festival of Shavuot, which we've turned into Confirmation Day, is traditionally associated with the Matan Torah, the giving of the law to Moses on Mount Sinai. That's the time of the year when the image of the revelation at Sinai is most present in the consciousness of the Jew. And in the weeks immediately preceding this festival, which celebrates the giving of the law, the rabbis wanted to make clear that the law which had been given there was their law, the twofold law, and not simply that law, the written law, the law as that the Karaites assumed. Is there any other proof that we can bring to this kind of reconstruction? Simply this, that in organizing the liturgical use of these six chapters, the rabbis added to, as a superscription, added to the reading, a paragraph which begins with a line from the Mishnah, concludes with a line from Isaiah. The line from Isaiah is simply messianic. It promises eternal redemption for Israel in its own land because they are a good and faithful people. The line from the Mishnah, from Sanhedrin, is interesting. It says all Israel has a portion in the world to come. It's a promissory statement. But the text that it comes from in the Mishnah has other kinds of vibration, because after it states all Israel has a place in the world to come, we're all to be rewarded, it goes on to make a series of exclusions of those who are to be denied the reward, those who have no place in the world to come because of their heretical, unorthodox views. And so obviously what they were doing was to make the reading of this text a proof of one's orthodoxy. And not to read the text was proof of being a Karaite, a dissenter, one who denied the law. And if you look at the very beginning paragraph of the Sayings of the Fathers, you'll see that it's organized not as all the other paragraphs, a sage and what he said, but that it stipulates a ladder or a chain of tradition. Moses received the Torah at Mount Sinai, and Moses gave it to Joshua, and Joshua handed it to the elders, and the elders handed it to the men of the great synagogue who used to say. And then the last of these men said something else, and then the disciple of that man said something else. There is this assumption of an historical chain of tradition, an unbroken chain. And the Torah which is being received in this way is obviously the oral law, the full tradition. How do we know that? Because all the authorities who are quoted are those who assume the validity of the twofold tradition. Now, we've been talking a little bit about the reception of the Pirkei Avot as part of our liturgy. And I find it a little bit ironic that we who claim to be liberal Jews, who deny the twofold Torah, that is, who all of us say there's great wisdom in the Talmud and there's great insight in the Midrash, but we do not assume the rabbinic tradition to be part of God's revelation, that we continue this tradition. I guess what it really says is that we continue to find value in the text itself. The ideas still have meaning for us and benefit to us. For we certainly, as liberal Jews, are not taking an oath of fealty to the oral law in this period between Passover and Shavuot. Well, let's move back. That explains how the Sayings of the Fathers became part of our liturgy. How did the Sayings of the Fathers come into being in the first place? Actually, these six chapters represent not one book, but two. The Pirkei Avot is a compilation of two works which were edited in the 3rd century, early in the 3rd century. Chapter 6, the last chapter, is called in our tradition a Braita. That means it is a compilation of material by the rabbinic sages of the 1st and 2nd century, edited probably early in the 3rd century, all of which has to do with encomium and praise of those who study the Torah, praise of the value of the Torah for study on its own. The first five chapters are more interesting. They appear in the Mishnah. They're one of the 63 books of the Mishnah text. The Mishnah, as you know, is the fundamental code of Jewish law, compiled early in the 3rd century by Judah Hanasi, Judah the Prince, based on some earlier editions. And what's interesting about this little book is that it's unique among all the 63 books which comprise the Mishnah. 62 of these books are simply lists of law surrounding one theme or another theme. Only this book deals in ethics or in philosophy or in theology. This book alone is what we call agadic, non-legal in its basic concern. It's unique. It must therefore have had a very special purpose. What could its purpose have been? Well, again, we turn to the title. It's called in the Mishnah Masechet Avot, the book of the ancestors, the book of the fathers. And we look at its place in the Mishnah. It comes after the first four great collections, compendiums. There are six before the last two. The first four are the compendiums which deal with the oral law, rabbinic law. The last two deal with the organization of the temple and the cult, which had been very old, which preceded the rabbis. And if we think back again into the history of the time, we come to one of the great watershed periods in Jewish history, the time of the revolt against Rome and the destruction of the temple. The time which preceded the revolt against Rome was very much like our own day. That is, there were any number of varieties of Judaism which were held to be legitimate. They didn't have reform and conservative and orthodox, but there were those who were monastics who felt that Judaism required a dropping out into the wilderness, a life of celibacy and purity, of asceticism. And there were those others who said that Judaism is nothing more than occasional attendance at the temple in Jerusalem and a life of good deeds, life organized by the very simple rules of the five books of Moses. And there were the Pharisees, a minority group at that time, who insisted that Judaism required a very strict diet, strict laws of ritual purity, the study of ancient traditions, and the affirmation of some very old traditions which governed their lives, traditions dealing with diet and ritual purity and the study of ancient texts. There were these and many other attitudes towards Judaism, many other groups. But basically, the average Jew, I suspect, in those times was a very simple man who said, if I go to temple once or twice a year on the holidays, if I follow the calendar, and if I follow the good deeds which are incumbent upon me as a human being and as a Jew, that's genug. That's enough. That's what God requires of me. There was not very much difference between the Jew of that day and the Jew of this one. But then came the destruction. The temple, the central apparatus, the redemptive apparatus was closed, was no longer. The priests and all they represented were scattered. They couldn't perform their traditional functions. What could preserve Jewish life? And as it happened, the only group who had a tradition which was broad enough and assertive enough and clear enough, the only people who had a theology which could offer men the promise of immortal life despite the destruction of their political promises, so the only group which had all of these benefits were the Pharisees. And after 70, after the destruction of the temple, those who had been a minority became the dominant group. Pharisaic Judaism is the root from which all that we call rabbinic Judaism, all that finally becomes Orthodox Judaism in our own day, emerges. The minority becomes the majority. And by the end of the second, the beginning of the third century, they had their schools and their authority and their rabbis had become the dominant people in the organization of the diaspora, in the organization of the synagogues and the communities of Jews around the world. And the Mishnah is the first attempt by these people to draw together their traditions. And when you draw together your tradition, you want to assert your authority. And the ancients were very much unlike us in this one respect. We worship the new. The best thing you can say about a scholar, a thinker, is that he's creative. God forbid that he should follow the ancient ways and be trained in the ancient traditions. If he's creative, that covers a multitude of sins. But for a man to be creative in ancient times was to damn what he did. Because one's authority came from the revelation, came from the word of God. What needed to be in those days authentic, orthodox, traditional. These were the value terms which were affirmed. And the rabbis wanted to assert that they were authentic, traditional, that they were not new and creative. In fact, they were. But by establishing this chain of tradition, by showing that from Moses, their teaching had been the dominant teaching. They were, in fact, asserting their claim to authority. And it's a claim they want to assert still to this day. We had an interesting little contretemps in the development of our 125th anniversary Temple Men's Club lecture series this year. When we listed each of the titles, we decided to get the best person that we could to speak authentically from within one or another of these traditions. And so I invited Rabbi Schubert Spiro of Young Israel Congregation in Cleveland to speak on Rabbinic Judaism. He's a fine scholar and a good authority. And in working out our publicity for this lecture, I said in the publicity very simply that in addition to explaining the background, the history of Rabbinic Judaism, we would show how Rabbinic Judaism was in itself a reform of Biblical Judaism, a change of what had come before. And Rabbi Spiro took great offense at this, because in his tradition, Rabbinic Judaism, what the Pharisees, the Talmudists taught, was not a reform at all. It had existed since Sinai. It had always been there. They simply drew out the implications. In fact, it had not always been there. The assumption that there was an oral tradition is a leap of faith into the past. The rabbis, the Pharisees, developed these traditions and made them normative. Until today, we assume them to be coeval with Judaism historically from beginning to end, but in point of fact, they were not. The sayings of the fathers were designed to make it very clear to those who were within the Mishnaic, Pharisaic tradition that they were authentic. Unfortunately, if we look critically and historically at what seems to be a chain of tradition, there are a lot of holes in that chain. Who are the elders to whom Joshua gives the text? There are 2 centuries between the men of the great assembly, the men of the time of Ezra, and the priest, Simon the Just. There is nothing in Josephus, there is nothing in Ecclesiasticus, there is nothing in the ancient texts which tell us about Simon the Just, which make us believe that this man whose major claim to fame was that he was one of the great rebuilders of the sanctuary in Jerusalem, because he had an edifice complex, that this man would in fact be one who gives what is the quintessential Pharisaic platform. The world rests upon 3 things, upon Torah, that is upon the whole written and oral tradition, upon Avodah, that is upon temple worship and synagogue worship, and upon Gemilut Chasadim, upon good deeds. He would agree about Gemilut Chasadim, the good deeds. He would agree about temple worship. But that the Torah, that the world rests upon Torah, upon the study of these ancient traditions, upon their authenticity, is something that I doubt Simon the Just would ever have agreed to. And between Simon the Just and this man Antigonus of Socho, of whom we know only in all of our tradition this one phrase, there was at least another century and a half. So what we have here is really the development of a myth. The myth which underlies all that is beautiful and great in Rabbinic Judaism. The assumption that Judaism as they created it, as they defined it, was in fact a Judaism which met the criteria which any reform had to meet in those days. Not that it had met the demands of the New Age, though in fact it did, but that it met the demands of being authentic, of having been spoken at Mount Sinai. And in that phrase, a tripartite phrase associated with Simon the Just, we have the world as it is seen and known by Rabbinic Jews over the last 2,000 years. The world rests upon 3 things, upon the Torah, upon worship, and upon acts of loving kindness. We believe that the world rests upon Torah, but we define Torah as the inherited wisdom of the past, not as the revelation, the specific revelation of God. We would agree that the world rests upon avoda, upon worship. But to us, worship is meditation and liturgy within the synagogue, not the sacrifices of the ancient temple. It is evolving rather than set. And of course, we agree that chasidut, Milut Chasadim, the acts of grace, goodness, concern, sympathy between one human being and another are quintessential in any religious tradition. But much more could be said about any of these sayings or about the sayings of the fathers or the Mishnah book of Avot, about the tradition in the past. Suffice it to say that I find it a tribute to the liberality and the insight of our own modern tradition that we can keep this text, which came into being as a proof of one's orthodoxy, well in the tradition of a liberal movement. Because to read it is to learn, to gain an insight, and after all, to open one's eyes more clearly to the world about us is one of the basic dimensions of any religious movement. The sayings of the fathers, read them. You'll enjoy them. Amen.